All right. So we're picking up here at this this point in the Grecian history. All right. Biblically, we are right in that period in Daniel chapter 8. You remember where you've got the ram with the two horns. That was the Persians. And then you have the he-goat with the one horn. That's Alexander the Great. All right. So the one horn represents Alexander the Great. We'll look in a moment as they collide and that one horn divides into four horns, and we'll see who those are as we go through the remainder of Alexander's conquest. Also, after we get through that, before we get to talking about the divisions and so forth, I want to take just a few moments in that time between there to talk about why this is important and why this is meaningful to us to at least have some grasp of these histories. I will say this, look, you know, I don't know how you feel about the pace and everything, about, oh, this is going way too quickly or way too slowly. We're covering a great deal of history here. And to put it in perspective, imagine if someone were to ask you to tell them about American history, all of it, in about 45 minutes. All right, that's the kind of amount of history we're talking about, and then some. All right, we're covering vast amounts of time, lots going on. We're leaving a lot on the table. We're not dealing with all of it. We are dealing, as Freddie mentioned in his prayer, as it relates to the Bible, as it relates to the Bible people and to prophecies. We're going to hopefully spend some time in Daniel chapter 11 then this evening and talk about some of the specifics that Daniel mentions prophetically, pointing to some of the things that happened in the Greek Empire. All right, if you look at this map, this is the map of the Grecian Empire as it stood after the conquering by Alexander the Great. The dotted lines, let's see here. Is that showing up there? Can't see. There we go. Okay. All right. See these dotted lines right here? That is the territory that Alexander the Great actually conquered. You know, these are the places that he extended in his running throughout the territories. You see it goes all the way over past the Indus River and into India. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. Then the territories, the colored territories, are the way that the property got divided up. And we'll talk about that a little bit more as we go along. Where we left off the other night, he had come down from Macedon. This is where he started. His father was Philip of Macedon, if you remember. And so he comes across and comes down through this territory. He comes around the Mediterranean and begins to make his way down the Mediterranean coast. He gets all the way down to Tyre, and we talked about that that siege of Tyre in which he's able to take and conquer that, some of that prophesied back in Ezekiel. He continues to make his way down the coast. There's a point at which he makes his way over to Jerusalem, and Robert talked a little bit about that. One of the things that's important to note is when he took Tyre, at that point, he gains control of the sea, at least in so much as it relates to this portion of land, because south of Tyre, there's no good ports. All the ports we read about in the New Testament, those come later. All right. There's no natural ports for large ships. And so at this point, what he does when he takes Tyre is he says, Alexander the Great, he says, any ships that land here have to pledge loyalty to me. If they don't, they're pirates and basically will kill you. So, you know, that's an easy choice. So they pledge loyalty to him. So he owns the sea at that point. He comes down. He doesn't really meet any more resistance except small Persian resistance at Gaza there. And the map, this whole map is tilted a little bit this way from what you might normally be used to seeing, you know, if when we're just looking at the area of Judea. So that's why you see Gaza. I keep losing my dot here. Why you see Gaza down here instead of where we might normally think of it up here. Anyway, he comes around into Egypt. Egypt's very friendly at this point because they're ready to get rid of the Persians. And, of course, Alexandria, as we mentioned on Sunday, is established. At that point, after he fairly well conquers Egypt, he turns his attention back to the north and to Darius. You remember, the last we heard of Darius, he ran off, left his mother and wife and children and so forth in the middle of a battle. And so he turns back north in order to finally conquer the Persians for once and for all. So he goes there and he marches north. He comes up to battle with Darius once again, and he's outnumbered 5-1, which is seems to be the order of the day in coming upon the Persians. Again, his superior training of his forces, the superior knowledge and so forth, experience, is able to overcome the Persians. They quickly rule the day there, and Darius again takes up and runs. And he and his forces, they're at the time of the battle, they're up here right about Gargamela, up here in the northern part of the Mesopotamia. And so Darius begins to flee this direction. Well, Alexander the Great just heads right after him, and because of the training of his forces, he's able to be relentless. And Darius, they're marching, and he's got, you know, he's got his kind of volunteer service here. And Alexander the Great, he's coming on with people who are professionals. I mean, that's the difference right there. You got professional soldiers, and you got people who said, yeah, I'll go with you. You know, it's totally different. And so these superior forces are able to hound them so relentlessly that finally Darius's forces basically say, we're done. And he tries to goad them on, but it ain't happening. And they just turn around and kill him. And reports vary as to whether they left him for dead or left him already dead. I don't know if he's mostly dead or all dead, but at any rate, when Alexander comes upon him, he's either dying or already dead. And at this point, Alexander sort of recognizes him as a valiant opponent. He takes his cape off and places it over him, gives him a royal burial and so forth. And so ends, for all intents and purposes, the rule of the Persian Empire. From there, he goes on to continue to conquer. And of course, they're people without a leader now. And so he conquers particularly these three cities, Ecbatana, Susa, and Persepolis. And those three cities would be important because they're the major treasury cities. So he gets control of the money next. And the money is incredible. It's 180,000 talents. And I forgot to calculate that, but just a whole lot of money. And so now he's got control of that. Well, now that he's got control of that, he keeps on pressing. And he keeps going this direction, and he goes over into India. And once they reach this point, Alexander says, it's time to head on to Carthage. And his soldiers go, no, we're done. This is enough. This is farther than anybody imagined we would go or get to. And it's time to go home. Another thing that started to develop at this point is that his soldiers are kind of getting put out with him, because part of the reason for this whole affair was to spread the Greek culture. But now Alexander, he's gone and married a Persian woman, and he's starting to dress like the Persians. And he seems to think that there's some value to their culture. He's kind of gone native. And so they're thinking, this is not what we signed up for. You know, we signed up, it was all about Grecian empire and about Grecian culture and so forth. So for those reasons, and just being tired, they sort of begin to lose their zeal in continuing to follow after their leader. So the campaign sort of stagnates. Well, in addition to that, at this point, Alexander has sort of let the success go to his head, and he begins to act like maybe some of our more successful athletes today, and does whatever he wants. He drinks. And he womanizes and so forth. And there are varying reports as to why he may have died, may have contracted some sort of fever. And of course, with the immune system of a life lived like that, it would have caught hold quickly. Some people say his soldiers poisoned him. Don't know exactly what happened to him. At any rate, he died, and he died very young. In fact, at the age of, I think, 32 years. So 32 years old, and in about 10 or 11 years, this young man has conquered the whole world. I mean, you think about that. 21 years old, and he sets out with a military and conquers all and more than the known world. It's extremely impressive. And yet, so much of Solomon's wisdom comes up here. What did that amount to? Nothing. Nothing. In fact, the son that should have been his heir wasn't even born when he died. So it's not like he could even look and see the heir that this would be passed on to. I mean, it's just over as quickly as it began. So his conquering sets the stage for what will be so much of the influence that we're going to look at and that really still affects us today. But it's not his personal influence. Rather, it's the influence of those who would come after him. At this point, we're about 323 BC is when Alexander the Great dies. Now, I want to just point some things out about why it's important to sort of understand some of this as we move forward into the next section, as we kind of break this empire up into pieces. So we've already left off. We left off toward the latter part of the Medo-Persian Empire with the inspired narrative. All right. So the Bible's telling us the story up till that point, and then aside from the prophetic words of Daniel, we don't have anything to tell us what's going on between the latter portion of the Medo-Persian Empire and when we open the pages of Matthew or Luke and look and see what's happening there. So lot changes in that time period. And there are people who are being referenced in the New Testament, and we don't even know where they came from. But when those people heard the names that are being referenced throughout the New Testament, they knew exactly who they were talking about. And it would call up all sorts of imagery. If I were to call up various names of leaders that we're more familiar with, imagery would be called up with those names. I mean, if I were to just call out some of the names of the American presidents, depending on what you think of them, there would be things that you would associate that with. So imagine, you know, when they heard Herod, when Herod's being talked about, that's not just some ancient leader to the people who are reading this. That's a man who's tied up very closely, and this will come out later as we go along in the history. He's tied up very closely with Israel's history. There's animosities there. There's infighting there. And so they know who he is. When we talk about the Pharisees, you know, that's a long line leading up to who they are, what that name defines and what it means. And so as we study this history, in addition to helping us see this fulfillment of prophecy, it also sets the stage so that when we open the book of the New Testament, as much as possible, we can try to read that with at least some sense of what those people would have heard. Think of how much more meaningful it would be to sit in a history class if someone were to be talking about a battle. And instead of talking about streets you've never heard of and cities you've never heard of and rivers you've never been to, they say, I tell you what, this army marched right up I-65, crossed that long bridge over the Tennessee River, you know, came up into Athens, marched up Jefferson Street, and then an army came over from Clinton. And so you're going, oh, I know where all those places are. And it's, you know, when we read Bible history, sometimes it's just faraway places. The people that were reading this in the first place, it's all immediate. It's all familiar, or at least much more familiar than it is to us. So I think that speaks to some of the need, some of the benefit to studying this kind of history, to make it real and understand the setting that these things happened and these things were written during. All right. Now, as we go and we are looking back at Daniel chapter 8, this prophecy of the ram and the he-goat. Daniel chapter 8. And you look there in verse 3, lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, a ram which had two horns was standing in the front of the canal. And two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, and the longer one coming up last. I saw the ram butting westward, northward, and southward, and no other beast could stand before him. So there's your Persian army. Now, verse 5. While I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west. All right? So coming over there from the west where Greece would be, from Macedon. Coming westward, or coming from the west, and it says there that he had a conspicuous horn, so one horn jutting out. And he came up to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, rushed at him in his mighty wrath. I saw him come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him, and he struck the ram and shattered his two horns, and the ram had no strength to withstand him. All right, so there's your Persian Empire falling. He hurled him to the ground and trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram from his power. All right, so it's utter devastation. Then the male goat magnified himself exceedingly, but as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken. All right, so there's a Grecian Empire coming up, right? As soon as he's mighty, as soon as he's conquered, then the large horn's broken. So Alexander falls. And in its place, there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. All right, so now we break the kingdom up. And here's how this came about. All right, so Alexander dies. The people who are left after Alexander are his mother, a probably mentally handicapped brother. All right, so there's a potential heir. He has a son who was born after he had died, and his wife Roxanne, which seems a peculiar name at this point in history, but at any rate, so Roxanna. So at any rate, that's his mainly four family members that are still around after he dies. Well, he's got a friend, Perdiccas, who was particularly close to him, and he was made guardian of the two heirs, of the brother and of the son. And so there he is, watching over them. Olympias is the mother, incidentally. She's going to come back into the story in just a few moments before she exits. But at any rate, so he's over them. And then there are about six generals that became regents over various portions of the empire. All right. A man named Ptolemy ruled Egypt. And then a man named Seleucid, which we'll be talking more about, came to rule Syria. And then you had Antipater ruling Macedonia and Greece, and Antigonus ruling Asia Minor. All right, so those are four main generals that we're concerned about at this point. All right, well, it doesn't take very long before they're recognizing that Perdiccas, he is way too close, or he's got too much power by being guardian over these two heirs. Basically, he's in control of who's going to be the next king, and they don't want that. So they assassinate Perdiccas in 321. And in his place, they put his son, who I suppose they thought they could control, Antipater became the guardian at that point. That's right. So Antipater becomes the guardian after they assassinate Perdiccas. All right. Well, then they think, of course, Antipater's got too much power, so he's assassinated, and his son Cassander is put in the place of Antipater. Well, Olympias, the mother of Alexander the Great, she's looking around, and she's thinking, you know, if Philip ends up, that's the sort of mentally handicapped son, and it's not really her son, in fact, it's her son by another husband. If he becomes king, that really won't work out well for her. So she has him killed, and along with his wife. Well, Cassander didn't like that, so he drowns her, along with Roxanna and Alexander, just to get them all out of the way. And so then that leaves just the generals to fight over this. All right. And you don't have to remember all that. None of that's going to be on the final. But you just see, you know, that while there is greatness here from a military perspective, it's a mess. And this also just shows you the nature of how things turn from one leader to a next during this time period. That really goes back all the way through all of these other empires. It's a very messy succession. It makes me not quite as depressed to look at an election cycle here in America. You know, I'm like, okay, it could be worse than whatever we go through, whatever antipathy we go through every election cycle. This is a mess. And so, at any rate, Alexander is completely out of the way. And when it says the kingdom will be given over to those who are not his heirs. And so he doesn't have control. He doesn't have any direct succession over those who begin to take control. But now, back to our map. What's important for us to recognize is that there are four main divisions. The first one being Greece. All right. Greece continued to sort of be ruled somewhat like a republic. It remained sort of an independent city-state. It had rulers, but not really the dictatorships that the other three kingdoms had. Then you had Macedonia, north of Greece, and that was ruled by one of these generals. And then you had the Syrian Empire, which would be ruled by the Seleucids, and then the Egyptian Empire. But those are the four main horns that would be represented there in Daniel chapter 8. The two that we're concerned with is Egypt and Syria, ruled by a man named Ptolemy. The general who took that was Ptolemy, and a man named Seleucus, and they would be known as the Seleucids. The reason we're concerned about them is they're going to bicker for the next several hundred years. And who's right in the middle of all that? Well, of course, the people that we're concerned about, all right? And this ends up being the middle ground the whole time. They take over it for a little while. They take over it for a little while. And it's just sort of back and forth. In fact, for the most part, they have, the Egyptians have control of it for the first several hundred years. And then later, the Seleucids will finally gain some power and be able to take over control. But it's constant. It's constant. That's what we'll see from Daniel chapter 11 as we get there, is that constant seeking for control of that territory. All right. Now, back to some of the significance of this, and now particularly talking about the significance of the Greek Empire. Why is it important to know anything about what the Greek Empire is doing? Well, this world power right here is different from any of the world powers that have come before it. For one thing, Alexander's not like any of the conquerors before him. All right, so you've got before him, you've got the Assyrian Empire. They are brutal militarily and also just in the way that they treat the peoples that they conquer. The Babylonians come along and they seem to have somewhat better treatment. We see some of that with Daniel for sure, but they're also have their fair share of brutality. Then we finally have the Medes and Persians, and he certainly exercises a great deal of kindness towards the people who have been taken captive by sending them back to rebuild and so forth. Cyrus does. And they also, I think, have a more developed sense of law than any before. You kind of see that in the book of Daniel, you know, where when the king has said something, you can't just change that on a whim. And so it sort of sets a higher standard there. And so there's some interesting things there. What Alexander brings to the table for the first time, you've got a world power seeking to gain control in order to really change society. All right. There's even, you might say, benevolent intent. What's interesting, though, of course, is Alexander, like so many benevolent dictators, sort of says, I want you to learn about Greek culture. I want you to be educated. I want you to read. And if you don't want to, then I'm going to kill you. And that's the way a lot of, you know, people who intend to do good for the people have done throughout the ages. But he was sort of the first in that long line of megalomaniacs who thought they could do better for everybody. But at any rate, he succeeded. He succeeded in spreading that culture. What he started out with is, hey, we've got more to offer here than anybody else in the world. Everybody ought to have what we have. So that's a little bit different than just let's take over as much territory as possible so that we can get as much money as possible. So he has that idea. And so that's different. And it sort of homogenizes, therefore, all of this territory that's being taken over rather than, you know, these people still do what they do and these people still do it. No, they're all going to be Greek. We're all going to speak Greek and we're all going to learn that. However, he also wanted to sort of bring all of that together. It wasn't just to spread Greek culture, but also what he wanted to know was, what's the best of your culture? Let's translate that into Greek. Well, that's pretty important because when he gets to the Jews, what does he take? Well, the Greeks, well, not Alexander, but later, they'll take their scriptures, our Old Testament. And they'll translate that into Greek. And so for the first time, people all over the world will be reading God's word. And it's because of the philosophy of this man right here who's trying to take over the world. And yet for us, we're going, maybe Maybe it wasn't just him involved in that process, of course. That's the way we're looking at it, recognizing God's control of all of it. And so there are a lot of things that sort of set the stage. Along that line, the Greek language then becomes more universal than ever than any language has been before that. Up to this point, the most universal language has been Aramaic. You see that some of the Jews, basically the diplomats of the Jews, knew that language because if you recall, when the Assyrians came down, when Sennacherib came down to conquer Israel, and then they came into Judah, they sent an envoy there to the gates of Jerusalem. And when Hezekiah is king, and they come up and they begin to speak in Hebrew. And the people at the gates are like, hey, we know Aramaic. You just go ahead and speak the language of diplomacy. And of course, the people that come up to the gate said, no, we want the regular people to hear what we're saying. And so they continue to speak in Hebrew. But that just shows that only the diplomats really knew that language. It was not everybody's language. It was just the language of diplomacy. French became that later on. English seems to be that for the most part now. But Greek, well, this is different. Everybody's learning it. And everybody's speaking it. And even the Bible is written in what is called Koine or common Greek. I mean, the Greek that normal people spoke. It's not some, you know, highly educated language. That would be Latin at that point. This is the language that normal people spoke. As you look at the things that are being developed here, the philosophies, the theories of government, and society and so forth, so much of this lays groundwork for the Romans and for really the rest of history. People are still studying the theories, the government theories, the Republic by Plato and so forth, even today. And so this is a very significant history, and also as it relates to the time in which Israel would have lived. Back to the language, though, one more thing. Literacy is more universal than ever before. All right, so truly Alexander the Great and his followers thought that everybody needed to read. Everybody needed to have access and be able to read those works and to discuss those works. And so it wasn't just the universities where this sort of education was happening. It was across the board. So look at that, all right? And then the Romans will add some more things to this as far as, you know, peace kind of throughout the territory, roads and so forth. We'll get to that later. But this sets the stage. In Galatians chapter 4 and verse 4, it says, in the fullness of time, God sent his son. Now, we don't want to take that too far. We don't want to make too much of it. But there's just so much falling into place here. There's so much that makes this such an ideal point in history to bring a new message and to get it out as far and as wide and as quickly as possible. And it's extraordinary to look at it that way. It's extraordinary to see ideal nature of this time, and therefore to see God's hand and bringing all of that about and making this making usage of what at first glance it's just history. Oh no, this is God. This is God, as he's told Daniel, taking care of his plan in the lives of what seems to us to be so much chaos, perhaps. All right. Well, over to Daniel chapter 11 then. Daniel chapter 11. Okay. So in Daniel chapter 9, you have Daniel, he says a prayer to God. And he sees a vision. There's a man described there. And he sounds a little bit like some of the descriptions we see in Ezekiel. Sounds like similar interaction with the angel of the Lord that we see on occasion. And Brother Waldron suggests, and I think there's good evidence and a good case to be made for this. Now, I wouldn't just harp on this, but a good case to suggest that this angel of the Lord and this man in this case who continually appears speaking to these people is the pre-incarnate Christ. That is, Christ before he came to earth. regardless of who it is, it's someone who's delivering the message who does not have the specifics of like Gabriel being mentioned by name in the New Testament and so forth. So this is a different kind of scenario. There's a piece missing there. We don't know enough to definitely identify him. In chapter 10, though, he begins to respond, and he responds by sort of giving Daniel a picture of what's going on behind the scenes. All right. This is what the conflict looks like from heaven. All right. But then in chapter 11, he finally gets around to answering Daniel's question. And what's Daniel's question? What's going to happen to my people? That's what Daniel wants to know. That's what might be what we would ask at that position. What's going to happen to my people? And so finally, starting in chapter 11, we begin to get around to that point. Now, we're going to skip over chapter 10 because one of the things that we need to recognize is that when conflicts from the heavenly realm begin being described, there's going to be more questions than answers. I can't tell you what all that's about. And in other words, I can't give you details about, oh, this means this and this means this. I think we'll have a lot better view on that, the other side of eternity, if you will. But chapter 11, well, that's nuts and bolts. That gets down to histories that are happening that we can look back to, and we can make some very clear and close connections. At this point in Daniel chapter 11, this is the part where historians go, this is too detailed. This couldn't have been written before. And so we look to some of these prophecies and we see some of these details. All right. So verse 2 through 4. And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings are going to arise in Persia. All right, so we're backing up a little bit. We're still in Persia. The fourth will gain more riches than all of them. As soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece, and the mighty king will arise, and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. But as soon as he has risen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants, nor according to his authority which he wielded, for his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others besides them. All right, well, there's the brief history of what we just looked at. All right, so there's this king rising up, and he comes against this king of Persia who was mighty. But then once he has taken them over, then he himself will lose his authority, and it'll be broken up into the four points. And it'll be given over to those who are not of his own descent. So we've already looked at that. All right. Picking up then in verse 5. Then the king of the south. There's Ptolemy. All right. As you go through the rest of chapter 11, the king of the south is Egypt. The king of the north is Syria, or Ptolemy for the south and Seleucid for the north. All right. So those are your two kings. The king of the south will grow strong along with one of his princes, who will gain ascendancy over him and obtain dominion. His dominion will be a great dominion indeed. All right. So here Ptolemy takes control of Egypt, and he rises up. And one of the things he does is take Seleucus, and he helps him to establish his kingdom. And that he takes that kingdom almost as far to the east as as Alexander did. And so he helps him take that massive portion of land, and sort of they parcel it out when they're all done. Incidentally, at this point, when they made their pact at the end of all of that, Seleucid was supposed to have control of Judea. And when he got back from that campaign, he found Ptolemy has sort of just moved the border a little bit and taken control. At that point, he doesn't do anything about it. Look, he's just helped me with all of this. Fine. It's his. All right. So we move on to verse 6. All right. After some years, they will form an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south will come to the king of the north to carry out a peaceful arrangement. But she will not retain her position of power, nor will he remain with his power, but she will be given up along with those who brought her in, and the one who sired her, as well as he who supported her in those times. All right. This is where, I mean, it's just kind of mind boggling. So what happened? Well, they, you know, after some discrepancies there, then we have the king of the south, that is Ptolemy. He sends his daughter, Berenice, up to marry the king of the north. who is the grandson of Seleucid Antiochus II. So he sends his granddaughter up there to marry him. Problem is, he's already married. And Berenice needs to be kind of prominent. So he divorces his wife, Laodice, puts her to the side, takes on Berenice. And, well then, you know, he just kind of got tired of her. I mean, it wasn't working out like he thought it would. And so he puts Berenice away and says, you know, I'll take you back, Laodice. Well, she says, okay, now that I'm back, the first thing I'm going to do is kill you. And then I'm going to kill Berenice. And then she sent her son to kill anyone who had anything to do with this whole plot. So, as the verse said, it didn't work out. You know, they attempted to make this this sort of alliance, and it just all fell to pieces. All right, verses 7 and 8. All right, there it says, but one of the descendants of her line will arise in his place, and he will come against their army and enter the fortress of the king of the north, and he will deal with them and display great strength. All right, so it literally here in verse 8 as well, it says, and their gods and their metal images and the precious vessels of silver and gold he will take into captivity into Egypt, and he on his part will refrain from attacking the king of the north for some years. All right. So literally there, when it says one from her line, it's a shoot from her roots, or a branch from her roots. It's her brother. So you go back down to her roots and one of the other branches comes up. He comes to the north and he just lays waste. I mean, he is conquering cities one after another, and the northern kingdom has fallen before him, and he takes spoils back with him to Egypt. But he doesn't take over. He just kind of goes back home. And so that's what happens here. He returns, having devastated, the northern kingdom. All right. Well, then verse nine, it says, then the latter will enter the realm of the king of the south, but, will return to his own land. So you remember the wife who was put away and brought back and killed everybody, her son, in response to this brother coming up, he goes back down to the Ptolemies, and he goes to try to destroy them. He stopped at the border and just kind of turned around and goes right back home. All right. And so you see how this back and forth. And let me just reiterate, remember where they're marching through. You might go, why is he telling Daniel all this? Because Israel's right in the middle of it. You know, they're watching this back and forth and back and forth. Eventually, they'll get a little bit more involved. But at least at this point, they're just sort of watching what's happening. Well, after that failure of that son there, there is another attempt there in verse 10. His sons will mobilize and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one of them will keep on coming and overflow and pass through, that he may again wage war up to his very fortress. All right. So at this point, there are several sons that come along and they come into the south. And I thought for sure that was the first bell. Sorry. But at any rate, several sons come down, and this is kind of a good ending spot. One of those sons is Antiochus the Great. And I'm just going to mention him because that's where we're going to pick up Sunday. Now Israel's about to get involved and really end up with a worse situation than what they had with the Ptolemies. So we'll leave off there with the Antiochus coming back down to the southern kingdom.